Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
So a lot of stuff going on in Washington. I want to dive into a lot of it this morning. The House voted to impeach President Trump yesterday. So first of all, how quickly could we see a Senate trial?
We could have seen a Senate trial as early as today. But Mitch McConnell has indicated that he will not agree to call the Senate back to begin the trial until after the inaugural. And so it would probably begin right after the inaugural or shortly thereafter, depending on what the schedule is for confirming the new appointees to the Biden administration, which is also very important because we need to confront the pandemic and revive the economy, and that requires people in the Biden administration being in place.
Okay, so a Senate trial is most likely not going to happen until after President Trump leaves office.
That's correct, and there's no reason legally that it can't be done after he leaves office. The important point here is accountability. His actions in inciting that mob attack, really an act of domestic terrorism, should have consequences, and accountability demands some kind of trial.
It does sound like, Senator Blumenthal, though, a big reason also for impeaching President Trump is because a lot of people want to block him ever running for president again. So the thing I had a quick question about is, if President Trump exits office next week, which it sounds like he will without the trial happening beforehand, even though he was impeached yesterday, can he still run for office in 4 years?
He can run for office unless he is convicted in a Senate trial by a two-thirds vote, which requires 17 Republican senators, and also that a majority vote indicates that he cannot run again. Now, remember, Melissa, that there's precedent for conducting a Senate impeachment trial after someone has left office. A cabinet secretary, judges, they've all been held responsible and tried in the Senate, even though they've left office.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that's my question. So even if President Trump leaves office, which is what we're anticipating, that he will leave office before the Senate trial happens, is there still a good chance, would you say, that he will be convicted and then can never run again?
That's a separate question, whether or not Republicans, 17 of them, vote to convict him. And that's a question that certainly we don't know the answer to right now. Certainly some of them will. You know, some Republicans voted against conviction on the
last
impeachment
trial. Yeah, 10 of them did.
Because they said that he learned a lesson. Well, he hasn't learned a lesson. And so I think that there'll be a significant number. Whether there'll be 17, we don't know yet.
Okay. Talking to Senator Richard Blumenthal this morning. Now, separately, but also talking about what happened last week, Senator, I'm sure you know, I'm not sure if you agree with her, but a New Jersey Congresswoman, Mickey Sherrill, prompted an investigation into a group of people who apparently were at the Capitol the day before the attack on January 5th. She is calling on an investigation because, A, she wants to know if these people had anything to do with the riot. She also wants to know if members of Congress knew about this group and had anything to do with them knowing the layout of the Capitol and having a hand in the riot. What are your thoughts on this? Where do you lie with all of this?
I have no direct knowledge about members of Congress providing tours for these domestic terrorists. That allegation has been made by Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill. I believe there needs to be an investigation of that claim, also of claims that the Capitol Police were sympathetic to the mob and domestic terrorists who assaulted the Capitol, that maybe some of the white supremacists and violent extremists have infiltrated law enforcement agencies, maybe even the military. I think there's a need for a 9/11 type mission to look into many of these questions.
But do you believe that this group that came into the Capitol the day before, like that this was their way of finding out the layout of, because one of the things that Congresswoman Sherrill was saying was it just seemed incredible that these people knew the layout of the Capitol very well. They knew where Nancy Pelosi's office was. Like, they knew sort of where to go when they entered the Capitol. And she is sort of alluding that this group, this massive group that happened to come in on January 5th, she believes people in that group were part of the riots that next day.
That's an allegation that needs to be investigated, Melissa. But the other point is that no one was coming into the Capitol the day before, that is January 5th, without approval from an individual Congress person.
Right.
So this group that had a tour must have been there with some approval by a member of Congress, which raises, again, additional suspicion.
Yeah. Well, I know there's other suspicions as well, but this time with Capitol Police, a number of news outlets are digging into how the Capitol still could have been breached last week. Some of them are saying that there are some Capitol Police officers who just did not protect the Capitol, and that they actually let a couple of people come through. Like, there have been a couple of officers that have been called out in different articles about just letting people in or moving barricades or wearing a MAGA hat or, you know, just some different things I have read. So what do you do? Do you believe something has to be done to look at, like, our Capitol Police force? How do you respond to that?
There is an ongoing investigation of that response. And it's not only an internal Capitol Police investigation. It's also, my hope is, at least a Department of Justice investigation. I've asked for one. Overall, though, we do need to assess the whole domestic terrorism network in this country. That mob attack was planned and organized, possibly with dark money from these right-wing fringe groups, obviously incited and fueled by President Trump, who encouraged them to march to the Capitol and, as he put it, fight like hell. And he instigated the attack, but they were well organized to come to Washington. And we need to look in the whole issue of domestic terrorism and how prevalent it is.
We were just talking about the investigation into how Capitol Police responded to what happened at the Capitol. Now, there were some officers really were, to me, heroes in this situation. One was Officer Sicknick, who ended up dying from that attack last week, and many others who worked so hard to protect the lawmakers, anybody who was there. So this is not to come down on police at all. In fact, I'm a huge proponent of police, obviously. I'm a big supporter of them. I've never supported defund the police or anything. But that being said, there, like I said, are a lot of reports out there suggesting that some of the officers allowed protesters to come through to the Capitol. There was one that was mentioned of wearing a MAGA hat. There was another that there are pictures of this person taking selfies with the rioters. So my question to you, Senator Blumenthal, is, you know, you've got officers that allegedly did not do their job that they were assigned to do, which is to protect the Capitol. That's their job. That's what they are assigned to do. So when you have something like last week happen, how do you look at that? Like, is that looked at as treason? Like, how do you look at that for a Capitol Police officer to let political views change what they do as a job?
The simple answer is, Melissa, that personal views should have no part at all in what law enforcement, whether it's local police or Capitol Police or FBI, do in their jobs. Obviously, they have personal views, but they're supposed to leave them at the door when they leave home. Now, you're right about the Capitol Police. They perform, by and large, with enormous heroism.
Mm-hmm.
I was protected by several of them as I evacuated the chamber, very rushed, harrowing walk down the halls, seeing the protesters, an angry mob outside, not protesters, actually rioters with baseball bats and pipes and other weapons, carrying Trump and white supremacist flags, Confederate flags. They were an angry mob, and they walked me down despite the imminent threat to them with some of them with their guns drawn. So many of them performed heroically, as I saw myself, and then also in the video, the report, where they faced down this mob to enable senators and members of Congress to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And whether individuals, maybe a small, tiny fraction, let their personal views interfere with their performance of duties is something we should investigate, whether it's a disciplinary fraction, maybe a violation of criminal law, if they aided and abetted this armed insurrection that destroyed property, killed people, five people dead, and also injured countless others.
Yeah, and it put other people's lives at risk. And I think what's so unfortunate about this is, once again, I think that, as you said, the majority of those officers were unbelievable. I mean, brilliant in their actions. And I think that it's unfortunate that you've got this small, maybe few, that decided they didn't want to do their job that day and that they were going to see what was going to happen, knowing that these were threats. And it makes the entire Capitol Police, again, from the public standpoint, look like it's questioned. And I think that that's really sad. I'm hoping that even if we investigate these individuals, that there's a way to still build up the faith that people may be lacking in our police forces. Because to me, that's, I think, if we're going to take away the fact that there are a few, I hate using the term bad apples because people use it so much, but it's true. You know, like what you just said, what they did was incredible. But then you've got a couple who just didn't want to show up that day and do their jobs correctly. And they chose to do the wrong thing. And unfortunately, they're the ones who are going to be most remembered in most times. And I think that's really unfortunate.
And that's true in general about many emergency responders, mm-hmm. about police, about fire. The public really fails to appreciate how day to day they do their job with mm-hmm. enormous dedication and sacrifice and courage. So, as you said earlier, defunding the police is no answer when it comes to the Capitol Police or any other police, and we need to insist on higher standards, but avoid condemning everyone with a broad brush.
All right. Well, Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you so much for coming on and talking about all these things this morning. We'll talk again next week.
See you then. Thanks so much, Melissa. Take care.
All right. You too. Good morning, Dr. Brown. Thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, Melissa?
I'm doing good. Thank you. So I can't help but notice it's been over a week since we've heard about the new strain being detected here in Connecticut, but I find it super hard to believe that it's not here. So my question is, how do we actually find out that someone has the new strain or not? Like, how do you find out if you've been infected with the new strain versus the old one?
The first thing is that you probably won't get any different symptoms. So that's not really going to change. And I think the strain, even though it is a little bit different in the fact that now it's able to, you know, it's more infectious. So it's able to attach and it's able to cause an infection a lot easier than the last version or the last strain. You won't notice anything different. So the only way to tell if someone has the strain is if we do basically genetic sequencing. And we don't do genetic sequencing on sort of every COVID positive that we have. So that's really the only way. But honestly, a patient wouldn't be able to tell if they have it or not, and it still has sort of the same symptoms. What we will notice with this strain is that more people will become positive.
Okay. So, I mean, and I'm not making up something, I'm just trying to understand. Is it fair to say that it probably is already here widespread? We just haven't been able to, I don't want to say take the time, but it's not like we've taken the proper tests to find out if the new strain is, like, everywhere.
Given what we've seen in the UK, the likelihood that it is starting to be widespread in Connecticut is very likely.
Okay.
Just because that's sort of what it does. And again, it is a significant amount of complexity to determine because we're really what we're talking about is we're talking about a few little mutations in a certain area of its genome. So it is actually very, you know, it is sort of time intensive to figure out exactly what it is. But I can tell you throughout the state, all the hospitals and everyone who's testing are actually offering up a certain number of samples to determine if it, you know, where it is and what's going on with it.
Okay. All right. So that's good to know, kind of some random sampling going on. Now,
yeah.
Moderna's executive, I think it was yesterday, said a pretty bold statement that a lot of people, I think, are kind of having a hard time swallowing, but I'm not too shocked by it. I don't know about you. She said COVID will be here forever. What are sort of your thoughts on that? Do you, like, you know, I to me, you know, we keep hearing with infectious diseases, it's not like the vaccine eliminates COVID. It just helps you fight off COVID. So, I mean, is that really shocking to say it'll be here forever?
It is. I think there's a shock value to that, but it's not. That is not an incorrect statement. You know, now COVID-19 and in coronavirus is going to be part of sort of normal routine. Will it be as? I mean, again, will it be the same as it is now? Will it be, you know, the pandemic that continues on forever? Absolutely not. What will happen is that we will get control over it. You know, more people will get vaccinated. Hopefully enough people get vaccinated to really, you know, really quell what's actually happening now. And then this will be part of regular routine. I can imagine that we're going to be testing for flu and coronavirus for quite a while.
Talking to Dr. Fred Brown this morning. Now, have we gotten any updates or is it still too soon, Dr. Brown, if this is a one and done, you get the COVID vaccine and that's it? You never have to get it again? Or are we still not sure at this point?
That's a great question, Melissa. So let me just take a couple extra seconds to talk about that. So the answer is we're not sure, and there's two factors that are there. One factor is, you know, we're just not sure because we don't have long enough studies to say. If you look at sort of other coronavirus potential vaccines and what's been done in the lab, because there has been a vaccine or at least models of a vaccine that's been done for SARS-1, which was sort of the first coronavirus that came out in the early 2000s. So there is a model that's there, and it's lasted at least 10 years. Now, the problem is that because of the UK virus, you know, the UK strain, I should say, because of the UK strain, there's a lot more people who are getting infected. And that means if more people get infected, then the possibility for this to mutate more is significantly increased.
Oh.
If it's significantly increased, that means the vaccine that we have at this point, because it might mutate again, it could be a significant enough mutation that we'll all need to get boosters. Now, this is, makes it really, really important if people, you know, people get the vaccine. And if they get the vaccine, that not only protects them, but also protects everyone else from getting another shot.
Right. That's true. No, that's very true, actually. Yeah, that's down the line. That makes a lot of sense. Wow. Okay. Now, what about, like, is there going to get a become a point, I should say, like, you know, when you have children, they've got specific vaccines that they've got to get, basically. Do you see at some point COVID being, you know, I'd say like the flu vaccine where you start getting kids vaccinated at a young age?
You know, it's going to be, we're going to have to see how that goes. And again, because it's going to see how long does it last? You know, what are we seeing with its seasonal variation? Because right now, because COVID-19 was, you know, was a brand new virus to us, to humans, because it was a brand new virus, it just went widespread. The question is there going to be some sort of seasonality associated with it? You know, are we not going to see it in the spring and the summer, and are we going to see it, you know, crop up in the fall? It's very likely because that's what usually happens with respiratory viruses. So it may actually take a little bit more of a seasonality associated with it. So I would expect it to fit more in with sort of like the flu. And again, with the flu, then we'd figure out sort of who gets vaccinated for it.
All right. Well, Dr. Fred Brown of Griffin Health, thank you so much for coming on this morning. And we'll talk again next week.
Very, very nice. It was great talking to you, Melissa.
Always great to talk to you, too. Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. Checking in right now with Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau. Hey, Luke, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you? Happy New Year.
You know what? Happy New Year, my friend. I'm so glad that you're here this morning. This topic because I think, first of all, we're in the pandemic and a lot of our listeners have been staying at home. They're working from home or they don't feel comfortable going to the grocery store. So a lot of people have been turning to meal delivery services, which I think is great. But people should know things before they just pick the first service that's advertised to them. So first and foremost, what would you suggest if people are thinking, you know what, I think this is the route to go, get some meal delivery services. What do they do first?
Sure. So I would say, you know, create a budget, know how much you want to spend, and then see how much it's actually going to cost you. So a lot of these services have a lot of promo codes and coupons that come in the mail and through email, and you see posts about it. You know, 9 free meals. And what you need to know is that you're not going to get, you know, 9 free boxes of meals and not pay a penny. So how a lot of those promo codes work is it's a small amount off of each shipment. So that means you're probably going to have to get 5 to 6 shipments to even, you know, get the equal of what that coupon is telling you you're actually going to get. So it can get kind of confusing, yeah, on how it's billed. So again, even if you have to call, which I've had to a couple times, to just see how that coupon is actually going to be applied and then how much you're actually going to have to pay after that. And then also a great tip is ask how you can cancel prior to signing up for any of these, since all of these services operate off of an auto shipment or an auto charge plan. So it's going to charge you weekly and they're going to ship you meals weekly. You can't just choose 1 week an order box and be done. You are looped into an auto shipment plan. So asking about how you can cancel or how far ahead of time you have to cancel in order to not be charged is also a great tip.
Yeah. Well, those are all things that I feel like, you know, if you don't do your research ahead of time, in most cases, you're going to regret it later. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, what about, you know, especially like with the prices, by the way, like, because you see those deals of like, oh, you get the first 3 boxes, this, and then all of a sudden you think, well, I don't feel like I'm getting a deal here. That's smart. Now, this one I love because depending on your size of the family, this makes a lot of sense considering the ingredient quality and even just the amount that you're getting in your box. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. So all of them you can choose. I believe it's like 2 people, 4 people, and I'm sure that you could add on to that as well. So again, as you add on servings, it's going to add on costs. So again, calculating that into your costs. And then also if you have anybody in your household who is gluten-free, who is non-GMO, who is vegetarian, and seeing if that service has those options. And a lot of them do. A few of them actually partner if you are trying to get healthier in the new year. A lot of them offer healthy options. So, and you can choose your meals too. A lot of people who haven't tried any of these are like, oh, am I just shipped, you know, lasagna and a few things I don't like, you know, I don't eat fish, I don't like this. You can go online actually and choose your meals. So I would say the few I've used, there's usually around 10 recipes each week you can kind of choose off of. So again, if you have picky eaters in your household, you do have options.
Talking to Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau this morning. Now, what about giving out your personal information? Because I know a lot of people worry, especially when you sign up for one of these meal deliveries. You do have to give out, you know, personal information like your name, your credit card information, even your address. So what would you say about that?
Yeah, I think that's all fine. I just think, again, in terms of how you're being billed, a lot of people are like, hey, I didn't order another box. Why did you bill me? And when it comes down to it, you probably checked a box somewhere that allowed them to charge your credit card each week until you canceled. And on some, it can be hard to cancel. So again, I think mostly it's just all about reading that fine print and really knowing how much it's going to cost you even after that coupon expires.
Okay. And then I think the last thing, too, is, you know, can people use the Better Business Bureau in order to find out what is the best fit for them? Like, do you guys have reviews or anything?
Sure, yeah. So BBB.org, you can always go on there for any type of company, any business, including these meal services you can order. So yeah, go on BBB.org, check them out, see what, if any, complaints, what they're about. I always tell people, you know, just because a business has complaints, it doesn't mean it's a bad business. Mm-hmm. So if you read complaints, what are people complaining about? Are they complaining about how they're being billed? Is it the actual product? Is it, you know, a couple other reasons? So check those out and see if you want to, you know, try a new meal service. You know, a lot of people don't want to go to the grocery store anymore. So a lot of these companies actually make that a lot easier.
Okay. Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau, thank you so much. And what is your website again if people want to go check it out?
Sure, it's bbb.org.
All right, simple enough. Luke, we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Have a great rest of your weekend.
All right, sounds good. You too.
Thank you. We talk a lot about endangered species on this show, but a lot of times people immediately think animals. And today we're actually talking about plants, which I think is really neat, and they are just as important. So talk to us a little bit about some endangered species plants, rescue plants, what the zoo does to help out. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of people, again, I think it's kind of appropriate in the kind of the middle of winter here now to talk about the zoo's greenhouse. It's a neat place to go, especially in the deep, dark winter when it's very cold out, but you can go inside and have a little tropical experience. But the greenhouse is more than that. The greenhouse actually predates the zoo. The greenhouse is about 20 years older than the zoo. It's the oldest, one of the oldest structures. The potting shed is one of the oldest structures on the zoo grounds right now. And it's over 100 years old. We're approaching the zoo's 100th year anniversary, but the greenhouse actually is older than the zoo. It started out with people thought that the greenhouse was a cool place to visit. And a lot of people remember the greenhouse for roses. Our rose arbors that we had on the side of the greenhouse are places where a lot of people took their wedding pictures. And we're going to continue that as we move forward past the pandemic to try to get that institution back in to have people come take their wedding pictures up there. But actually, mums were the big thing at the zoo. We have photographs of and old postcards that the zoo had tremendous mum gardens. And it was pretty cool. And that also the plants that were just out there, that started the zoo because they used to put animals, birds in cages outside on the zoo grounds. And I'm out on the greenhouse grounds, and that kind of got people thinking about the zoo going on. So it was really kind of interesting to see that's how the zoo really started people thinking about it. But now let's move forward. We've increased the size of the greenhouse over the many, many, many years. It's now we got two sides of the greenhouse. One side is our education area and propagation area, and the other side is our exhibition area. The plants that we have in there, some of the plants in there, like our barrel cactus, our golden cactus, are over 100 years old, and they are an endangered species. People out in the West will sometimes go out and collect these and get them in from the wild and bring them into, you know, for landscaping, and that has made these plants become endangered species. Also, we had last year we had our century plant bloom at the zoo, which a century plant will bloom between 50 and 100 years. And we had one bloom last year.
That was really cool.
Not much of an endangered species, but really an interesting plant. But really, one of the plants that are in the greenhouse that I think people really have an affinity for, and again, people have them in their houses, are our orchids. We have many orchids in the greenhouse, and they'll bloom on different occasions. So we do have our propagation area in the back that will have the orchids sitting there as they're growing and waiting to bloom. And then once they get into bloom, we put them out on display. And we have many different types of them. But what people don't realize is that some of those plants are actually from a plant rescue program. We do have rescue programs with animals, as we know. There are animals out there that, like our red wolves and our Mexican wolves, are brought to the zoo. We have them at the zoo so we can keep them on our planet. But at the zoo, we also have a place where people have gone to Brazil or gone to South America and saw a really cool orchid maybe, and they put it in their luggage and they've taken it back, which is not legal.
So that's smuggling. They're smuggling plants.
It's a little bit like smuggling.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I don't think we go that deep, because I think people look at it and again, they don't make that jump between animals and plants. They think, well, if I take a plant out of the rainforest in South America, it's a plant. You know, and I'm going to put it in my luggage. I'm going to take it home.
Sure.
I'm going to put it in my house. It's going to be cool. It's not something that's going to be deleterious to the environment, but it actually is. You're taking a living thing out of where it's supposed to be, and it is part of the environment there. But if they take them into the airports and they get X-rayed and they see that they have a plant, then those are confiscated. You may get fined. You may have other things go on there. Again, if it's just being ignorant about this, it probably would just be confiscated from you. Now, years ago, what happened with these plants is that they would just be taken and basically thrown in the garbage, because the airline, the airports, and customs didn't have a place for these things to go. There really was, what are you going to do with them?
Right.
You can't ship them back to their country of origin because you don't know where they came from. You just can't, have it and then bring it back there. So they really were just destroyed. So over time, the federal government decided that maybe we could try something out. And what they did is they put a plant rescue system in, and Connecticut Spirit Zoo and the greenhouse is part of that plant rescue system. So they will call us up. We are on a list that says we will take in for orchids, aloes, and cactuses, because in our greenhouse we have different zones that we've created in the greenhouse that are for the wet plants, which are orchids, dry plants, which are cactus, and then kind of in the middle the aloes, which are also found down in the down south in South America. So we'll get a call every once in a while. They'll decide, can we take these? And we've done this over the years. We've probably had probably close to 200 orchids and other plants given to us from Fish and Wildlife, Department of Interior, to take care of these for them and forever. I mean, you can't sell them. You can't do anything. You just take care of them. And again, we think this is a great thing. Instead of having these plants expire, we're able to keep them at the zoo. We're able to talk about them. We're able to show them off. Some of these are beautiful, beautiful plants, when especially the orchids, when they bloom. And some of them actually smell like chocolate, which I think you would enjoy that.
That's really cool. I didn't know that. That's awesome. You'll have to point those out to me next time I'm there. Greg Danjo, thank you so much for coming on this morning. And wow, I learned so much about plants in 5 minutes. That's incredible.
All right. Unless you take care, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.